Hello and welcome to Tales from the Periphery, episode 12, with me, your host, Mike Whittaker. Those of you with functioning hearing will hopefully have spotted that we've tweaked the theme music a bit for this episode. This is partly in response to some amusing comments I got from some Americans on Facebook who were baffled about the, quotes, Christian symbolism, quotes, in the show logo, namely the big starburst on the end of the Wasp's fist. Now, just in case there's anybody else out there who's too young or from the wrong continent and doesn't recognise what we're paying homage to, the logo is very deliberately designed as a nod to the old BBC rock programme, The Old Grey Whistle Test, which was basically the place where you got to see things that were classic rock and generally not chart acts. Now, I've always been a soft spot for the show, and it looked like a fun way of doing a logo for a very British podcast. The reason for the changes in the theme music is that as part of responding to said people on Facebook, I went away and actually watched an episode of The Old Grey Whistle Test, or at least the opening titles, and realised that the theme music as I had it wasn't quite as stylistically similar to the original, which is a piece called Stone Fox Chase by a Nashville session band called Area Code 615. In particular, it needed a bucket load more harmonica and some percussion. So, wearing my other hat as a semi-professional musician, I tarted up the theme music, and there you have it. Apologies for the long gap between recording sessions. This is largely due to a couple of things, one of which is me having to run a science fiction convention in February, which was a little bit busy and fraught, and the other is I've been spending a lot of time helping my son get through his final computer science project, which has been a bit of a doozy. Anywho, here we are, and I thought I'd start by catching up with the fun things that have been going on apart from that. So, first off, the guys from Ponder's End ran an absolutely brilliant Alpha Strike all-day game set on Luthien. This was basically, in fact, two games. The first one was the Clanners trying to see if they could disable some anti-aircraft strike artillery points on the outskirts of Luthien, which they did fairly successfully. And the second was us as the combination of mercenaries and House Curita trying to prevent them from taking two out of three strong points in the middle of Luthien itself, which were basically a railway yard, and I forget what the other two, because they weren't the ones I was defending. For our side, there was myself, there was Bob, who you've heard on this podcast before, there was Dan and Josh from our club, who I'm sure I've mentioned before, there was Rich Shadowblade, who's a regular on the BT Discord, and two other folks whose name at this remove completely escapes me, but for which I apologise profusely, against a bunch of very well-organised clanners. I say this because some of them came in matching T-shirts with their names and ranks on, which I thought was taking things to excellent extremes. Between us, we had two lots of Kellhounds, some Wolf's Dragoons, and a whole bunch of House Curita forces ranging from Richard's rather nicely painted Otomo to my C3 company of Sword of Light, which was brilliant fun to build and play with. Basically, I wound up taking four Jenners, four Panthers, and a bunch of heavies, split into three C3 lances with the necessary magic to make them all collaborate. They were all fitted with Sashimonos, the back banners that, if you've got the Somerset Strikers box, you'll know the Hatamoto Chi comes with. I got some more out of, I think, a War Games Atlantic Ashigari box, which are 28mm scale figures, which fit beautifully on the backs of mechs, stay there with a little bit of super glue. And I basically drew them up so that they had Japanese Mahjong characters on the back with the numbers for 1 to 4, and the a dragon symbol, either red, white or green, that indicated which of the three C3 lances they were in. It all worked surprisingly well, actually. I'm quietly pleased with that. As for the second battle, I had... I'm going to claim credit for this because we had a great whale of a time, and I spotted fairly early on that given we had seven different companies and three objectives, there was no way we were going to hold all three. And so that the possibly the thing to do was to sacrifice one and hold the other two in strength. This actually turned out to work out really well. My C3 company got to hold the rail yard on its own, but we deployed me second or third out of the six, out of the seven companies, and then just didn't deploy anybody else to that starting area. And I wound up with bits of four different binaries facing me, which was painful, but surprisingly effective, given that none of them were going to reach the far objective and only a couple of them managed to get close to the middle objective. And we won pretty much on the last turn, which saw everyone piling up on the leftmost objective and a massive scrap ensuing, which Dan's Kellhounds, Josh's Kellhounds and Dan's other sort of light company eventually won with a bit of help from Bob's Wolf Dragoons. So that was the Luthien game. The other major thing that's happened recently is that we, as various members of Catalyst demo team, took ourselves off to Salute, which is the big UK wargame show, this past weekend, which is the 6th of April as we are now. Now, we didn't get the official support from Catalyst for this, mostly because it's only effectively, it will be a tier 3 con for them, and they're not bringing folks over for that kind of thing. But we did wind up, by dint of a little bit of talking nicely to the Salute folks, even though we got in with a late booking, getting a pair of sets of tables, which we'd have liked to have had next to each other, but were in fact about a third of the venue apart. And Stuart, who's been one of my guests, and Neil put on a rather nice classic Total Warfare table. Lots of lovely 3D printed scenery using Neil's new Bamboo Labs colour printer, which meant it didn't need painting at all. They had, by all accounts, a whale of a time. And we put on a game I've been talking about for a while, which is essentially Clan Jade Falcon, Vor Galaxy against the Northwind Highlanders on Terra in 3151. Now, the Americans who wrote the Ilklan book have some strange ideas that Normandy is somehow the gateway to Paris and that it's the obvious place to attack if you want to hit Paris, and I'm not entirely convinced that's true. But this is basically in Ilklan described as the attack on Redoubt Normandy. So we took a little bit of a liberty and we assumed that one of Jade Falcon's objectives was going to be to take Cherbourg, and as such they'd wish to come up the Contentin Peninsula, much like the Americans tried to do on D-Day. And it just so happens that as a club we have a 6mm scale model of Chef du Pont, which is a little area in the Contentin Peninsula on the way to Cherbourg, where the 82nd Airborne had a bit of a scrap on D-Day. So we repurposed that board. Basically, we removed the buildings, replaced them with some more sci-fi looking buildings, a long out-of-service comp-style building, a big power station, an elevated railway, And a small forward base for the Northwind Highlanders. And the basic object of the game was that Clanjade Falcon came scooting up from the east and attempted to take both the Northwind Stronghold and the power station. Much fun was had by all, I think. In addition to that, we ran a teaching game for Alpha Strike, which is the standard one we've been putting on at a few shows of late, which is basically the contents of the Game of Armoured Combat box and the rules from the Alpha Strike box, which, as I have got to the point that I'm almost tired of saying, are available as a free download from www.battletech.com. And of course, the Alpha Strike cards for the Game of Armoured Combat mechs are in the box, and with that and a little bit of scenery, you can get a perfectly nice and very nicely balanced in terms of PV Alpha Strike game. We must have ran that, oh, I don't know, 6 or 7 times. Dan was running it most of the time, a little bit of help from Rob and Josh from our club. And there were times when they were pairing up people, were giving people 2 mechs each on either side. And as I said, we ran it at least 6 times. Everybody seemed to really enjoy it. We also had people dipping in on the Chef du Pawn game at the same time. We made the point of talking to Element Games beforehand and saying, given that your stall is right next to us, you might want to bring some Battletech stuff. So they brought, I think, something like 8 Armoured Combat boxes, a bunch of beginners boxes, a whole pile of Lance packs. They couldn't get any Alpha Strike because, frankly, nobody appears to be able to get any Alpha Strike boxes at the moment. In addition to that, Leisure Games of Finchley, who you may remember if you listened to my rant about Salute from last year, were the only people with any stock at all, also turned up with some Game of Armoured Combat, a couple of beginner boxes, about a foot-long shelf of source books of various kinds, ranging from Ill Clan's Eyes Only and Force Manual Curita. Those stayed about as long as it took me to get to the stall and buy them. And a whole bunch of Legends, Legends 2, and most of the other Ill Clan source books, the Tokayid book, etc., etc., etc. They also had 4 mercenary boxes. Well, they actually had 1 mercenary box, and then they found 3 more under the stall. And I swear to God, it's the only time I've ever seen someone leave our game at a flat run for a trade stall in order to pick up a copy of the mercenaries box. We think that Element Games made about $1,000 in takings, and Leisure Games possibly a little bit more just on Battletech, because Element Games was sold out by 2 Clan Lance packs. And I think Leisure Games had 1 copy of Game of Armoured Combat. And that was about a few Lance packs and half the source books. So they'd shifted quite a few boxes as well, which is good. In general, it was really, really nice to see the number of people coming by and saying, oh, Battletech, cool. Or just knowing that they'd run across Classic, weren't sure they liked Classic, wanted to know more about Alpha Strike. And everybody seemed to be having a whale of a time. I think the most popular thing on our stand was the big A4 Alpha Strike card for a Battlemaster, which I printed out for start of game show and tell, which both Dan and I spent a lot of time just talking through to people, because you can literally explain the basics of Alpha Strike in about 3.5 minutes. Both Andy Dickinson, former guest of this podcast, and I reckon we can do it in about that time, enough that by the end of turn 1 or turn 2, people don't need our help, basically. The other people who came by the stall were on Tabletop, the Wargaming podcast, blog, YouTube vlog, whatever you want to call them. Thoroughly nice guys, but then that's been obvious every time I've watched them online. And they interviewed me. And if you hadn't realised by now I have a face and body for radio, you certainly will now. Although, to be fair, I did, to quote somebody who was watching it, you clearly are pretty good at talking as a hobby. They caught me pretty much cold. I got about 30 seconds to a minute's warning and no advance notice of the questions. And I thought, I kind of think that I did the hobby and Alpha Strike in general pretty well. So if you want to see that, there will be a link to it in the show notes. So that was Salute. look at what's in stock around the UK, there's not been a great deal new, although it does appear that the two main things that are currently popping up quite a bit on most stockists are the McCarran's Armoured Cavalry Lance Pack, the 2nd Star League Assault Lance, and the 2 Davian Lances, as well as some of the books like Force Manual Davian, Ilkhan's Eyes Only, and the Legends 2 book. Now, I'm given to understand from talking to some retailers that not all of those are being sourced through Asmodee. In fact, some of them are going through a German distributor. So my advice would be, if you're looking at the likes of Zartu, who appear to use Asmodee as their principal distributor, it's worth checking out the likes of Leisure Games of Finchley, who do very definitely not get their stuff from Asmodee, and are thoroughly nice blokes. I had a very pleasant time talking to them at Salute. They're keen to be supportive of the hobby, so they're certainly a trader I can recommend if you need to go and get your Battletech stuff. But ditto Element Games, who are also very friendly, very helpful, and thoroughly nice folks again. So, yep, there you go. Hopefully there'll be more stuff coming out soon. I'm particularly looking forward to the 3rd Star League Lance Packs and the Curita Lance Packs, which are fairly imminent, as well as the rest of the Mercenary packs and the Mercenary box set itself, which are mostly, I believe, waiting on being sure that everybody in the EU has got their Kickstarters and had them for a while before they actually start to appear. So watch this space and we'll see how things go. Before we move on to the interview, I thought I'd cover a couple of things I have been reading of late. So, in reverse order of publication, just to be ironic, we start with Blood Will Tell, which is the story of Danai Liao Centrella, heir to the Capellan Confederation, set in the late 3140s. It's a rattling good yarn. I actually didn't read this. I had it on audiobook, read by Lisa Lee, who's one of the few women who's been reading for Catalyst, and it's a brilliant read. She captures the various voices of the characters really very well. Particularly, you feel like you're getting very nicely into Danai's head, which is both a combination of her reading and Jason Schmetzer's writing. She's actually a member of 2nd McCarran's Armoured Cavalry. She is the inheritor of her cousin Kyalard's Yenlo Wang, which is now in about its 4th generation, now being equipped with a hatchet and a shield. And basically the story covers her antics on New Sirtis, on Hall, and basically being both learning to become a better commander and also being taught by one of the ancillary characters on how to lead and understand her role and the rest of the Capellan population's role in the way the Capellan Confederation works. It's a fabulous story. I really enjoyed it, and I would recommend you read it, not least because the book I'm about to be talking to my guest about is the sequel. The other book was also by Jason Schmetzer. It's actually set much further back in the history. It's one of the first books published after CGL got their hands back on things after the Dark Age stuff. It's Embers of War. And as I said, again by Jason Schmetzer. Again, surprisingly, set on Hall in the late 3060s. Essentially, you have the Stealthy Tigers, who are a mercenary unit who have been hired for one side of the fight for control of the planet, which is in the Chaos March. And as the book starts, essentially the Dismal Disinherited, yet another mercenary company, who are part of the Eye of Mercenary Command, are turned up on the planet to sniff out any connections with Word of Blake, who are just starting to become something of a pain around about now. In fact, we're sort of end of the Fedcom Civil War, beginning of the Jihad is coming fairly soon. And I'm not going to spoiler it for you, because there's some nice twists and turns. There are some really fun characters. It's a rattling good yarn. It's that kind of Battletech story. There's lots of good action, lots of intrigue. There's a battle in the middle. Not the big finale, but there's a very nice three-ish way battle in the middle, depending on how much you feel you trust one lot of the good guys, where I'm very, very tempted to build a table for it and run it as another big display, dip in as you can, Alpha Strike game, because I think it worked really well. Hall is this desert planet that's sort of split by lots of canyons, rift valleys, call them what you will, which would make for fascinating fun scenery. A lot of classic mechs, quite a few of which appear to be in the Mercenaries Kickstarter and its Lance packs. And I really enjoyed this one. In fact, I'm starting to think that Mr. Schmetzer is rapidly becoming one of my favourite authors. So, that's the books, and I think it's on with the important bits, namely the guests. I have guests. Specifically, I have Battletech author Tom Levine. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Now, we're mostly here to talk about the upcoming Blood Will Rise, which is the sequel to... I knew I was going to do that. Which is the sequel to Blood Will Tell.
Correct, yeah.
Which is the sequel to Blood Will Tell, which I have to say I absolutely adored on audiobook. And I really do need to get a print copy of so I can go diving into again. But before we do that... you're a new guest, which means we have a standard set of questions, well, which tend to sort of shift a little. Starting with the obvious one, which is, having had a look at your website, I note that you've been writing for a while. So how did you get into gaming? How did you get into writing? How did you get into Battletech?
Sure, thank you. I started writing very young. I was in second grade when I wrote my first story, and I was kind of had been writing ever since then, although in eighth grade, I discovered live theater, and so I kind of did a detour into that for about 22 years.
Okay, just pause there for a second to translate for the benefit of my English listeners. Second grade is how old?
That would be around 7 or 8 years old.
Crikey, okay. Yeah. So eighth grade, we're looking at 13, 14.
Correct, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then did live theater for about 22 years as an actor and director, and ran a couple of my own theater companies in and around Phoenix, Arizona in the States. And that was great. The problem with live theater, as much as I loved it, is it's a quick hit for storytellers. If you're going to do a show, you pick a show, you cast it, you perform it, and it's over, and the whole thing happens in 4 to 8 weeks, and then you're done, and you move on to the next one. Versus a novel, that's going to be several months of writing, months of research, marketing, publishing process, all that kind of stuff. So it's a much longer process. And if you're used to the quick hit, it can be kind of a difficult transition. But so I did that for a long time. And then in 2010, my first novel came out with Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing 9 what we call traditional novels with Random House, Simon & Schuster, and some other New York publishers. And then eventually, just within the last several years, I started doing some of my own work under my own imprints. And then I also did some work for the comic book Spawn with Image Comics. Ooh. Which was super cool. Yeah, that was a fun gig.
It's a very different mindset is writing for comic, isn't it?
Very different, yes.
I've tried my hand at it. I haven't actually had anything published, but I've written comic scripts, and it's a completely different approach.
Yeah, yeah. I really got thrown into the deep end of the pool there, which was good. It was a good way to learn how to do it, I think, ultimately. And then several years ago now, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, I got my first short story published in Shrapnel issue number 5, I believe. And that kind of opened the door to all things BattleTech. But I had been playing BattleTech as a kid, and probably 14 or 15 years old when I was first introduced to it. So 15-year-old me is really, really excited to be having this conversation about writing a novel for BattleTech. It's just such a dream come true. And I'm telling all my friends from high school and everything, you guys, we got it. We're in. We're there. You know, so it's fantastic.
And how did you, which bit of BattleTech did you start with?
So we started just before the clan invasion. So one of my, I've got all the technical readouts. We started with, I think, technical readout 2750, which I still have, and it's falling apart at the same time.
Oh, the scary tech one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's where I learned how to do it. I will say, just for clarity's sake, we didn't really play the game well. I don't think we had fun, but we had some players who were like, we have to play with assault mechs. That's all we ever use, which is cool, but also gets to be a bit boring after a while. Yeah. So we didn't dive into it as much as a lot of us would have liked, unfortunately. And I find myself now trying to play catch up with people in my town who are like, oh, have you heard of this game BattleTech? Like, yeah, I've heard of it. Let's go. But it's great.
Right. So let's do the quick fire round then. Classic or Alpha Strike?
Oh, classic.
Not tried Alpha Strike, or just didn't get on with it?
Oh, fine. I haven't tried it yet. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So far.
I think regular listeners will know that I'm slightly... I come from a wargaming rather than a board gaming background. Mm-hmm. And I like the lots of pretty painted toys on the table approach. So I tend to go for Alpha Strike because I can get more toys on the table in a club evening.
That's fair.
but there's something to be said for the incredibly crunchy and detailed... Mm-hmm. Blow arms off things rather than just knock boxes off a mech.
Yes.
Kind of thing. So I do like classic. It's just for the sort of the big sweep, it's more, you know, classic is kind of the shrapnel short story. Alpha Strike is the big Mike Stackpole.
That's totally fair. Yep.
Yeah. So toys on the table, painted or not?
Well, so I grew up using actually Lego minifigs as mechs. We didn't
have any
money. Whatever works, that's what we used, and they were great. We would lift an arm to indicate a torso twist, like, okay, I'm twisted that way.
Cool.
But yeah, lately, just in the last year or two, I've been able to get a little bit more into the actual figures. And my son, who is 13, is very much into painting all kinds of different figs and is getting into BT as well. So I'm assigning him to paint my mechs. He just came up with a great green shaded color scheme for one of my mechs, which was great. And then we're actually, as I'm working on some more BattleTech writing, I'm assigning him to do paint schemes for my like mercenary units and stuff, which is a great crossover. So I don't know if I'm answering the question, but
absolutely. Favorite era?
Well, okay. I am enjoying the Ilclan era because I'm in it currently, right? Like it's hard to not enjoy it when you're in there mixing it up with these classic characters and stuff. But if I couldn't do Ilclan, I would probably go back to late Star League, early Succession Wars, I think.
Yeah,
where I grew up.
I was fascinated to note that your first Shrapnel story is set in 2815.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that a deliberate choice?
I mean, yeah, it was deliberate. It wasn't so much deliberate in the sense of, oh, it needs to be, or I only want to work in late Star League or early Succession Wars, so much as that's what I was used to and comfortable with in terms of the mechanics a little bit. And so that's what I was naturally attracted to.
Of course, because starting with the 2750 tech readout.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I like revisiting that, but I am a fan of the Ilclan right now, for sure. It's a good time.
Mm-hmm. Favorite faction?
Favorite faction. So I had to think about this. I have a soft spot for the Taurian Concordat, having written for them before, written about them. I had a four-part serial in Shrapnel called Three Ways Home. It was a serialized novel, and I did a lot of work with them, and I really like them. And the more I got into their sort of way of life, the more it appealed to me. So I'm a big fan of the Taurians. I don't mind a little bit of Jade Falcon, but I think that's probably because of MechWarrior 2. That was another, like, just, you know, that's what we were handed. And so you get kind of an affinity for that. I'm coming to appreciate the Capellans, having spent so much time in their world.
Say, you probably have to after the last novel.
Exactly. Yeah, there's been a lot of time spent with them. But I think, you know, if I had to choose somewhere to live, I would be Concordat all the way.
And that's another early Star League era novella, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
For those looking for it, it's in Shrapnel 10, 11, and 12.
Yes, that
set
sounds right.
2850, set over, I'm just looking at the Sana page here, set over 9 days in 2851.
Yes.
Yes, I have it bookmarked. Unfortunately, I didn't get to grab my Kindle before I went out last night. I was going to be on the train reading since Michael hasn't managed to get me an ARC of Blood Rice.
Oh, I know. I'm so sorry.
These things happen. I'll just have to read it later. Favorite unit?
You know, I don't know. I don't have a specific one. And I think I'm so far behind on so much lore right now that I still have to catch up. So I don't know for sure. But I am looking forward to all of the great conversations I've heard about Fox Patrol. So I'm going to probably dive into that first.
But you are kind of stuck writing quite a bit about Big Mac at the moment as well, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you got to love Big Mac.
Second Mac have a lovely paint scheme.
That's true.
That blue and gold is really fun to paint. I'd get you some on that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, buy one of the McCarran Armored Cavalry Lance packs and tell her to paint them up.
Ooh, nice. I will do that.
There's Danai's Black Knights in there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Favorite Mac?
Okay, so I'm going to start by saying anything that carries more than one rack of LRM. I'm a big LRM fan, so I was kind of into the catapult, the longbow, things like that. I do like, from way back in the day, I was a big fan of the guillotine just because of the elegance of the build, the simplicity of it, and that outline, the profile with that sort of Eastern or Asian highlights that it had. Like, that's just a cool-looking machine. But Nothing but love for the Atlas.
That's Wade's mech in Breach.
Yes, right, exactly. Yeah, so there's, I might be showing my hand a little bit there.
Yeah, why not? it's why quite a lot of characters that I've written about have Battlemasters. I'm a big Battlemaster fan.
Right, there you go, exactly. I do, everybody, I think, I assume everybody has a soft spot for the Atlas just because it's such the... Like, that's the face of the game in a lot of ways. It's not the only one, but it's one of the top, probably three, I think.
The other one that always struck me as being, because it's kind of the quintessential hero mech, or actually it's the quintessential villain mech for the first few novels, is the Marauder.
And that was my last answer. Marauder 2 and 2C. Yep.
Gotta love them. All right. Favorite novel? Yours, well, you've only got the one. We've only got the one Battletech novel. And anyone else's?
Yeah, so I have... I didn't get into the fiction until later as an older kid, but I do enjoy the whole Blood of Kerensky trilogy that Mike wrote. I've been listening to that on audiobook for years now, and just really enjoyed that. He's a good friend of mine, and I've learned so much about the process and writing for IP and stuff like that. And I frequently return to Blood of Kerensky as kind of a touchstone.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned briefly the video games. Which one's your favorite?
So I actually had to look one of them up. Obviously, MechWarrior 2, which is, highly prized for very good reasons. And the music, oh my gosh, like that soundtrack.
A lot of folks seem to like MechWarrior 2.
Yeah, it's so good. It's still good, I think. But as I was kind of poking around about that, I had remembered there was another DOS game called, what is it? I had to look it up. The Crescent Hawk. Crescent Hawk's Inception. Oh my gosh.
The first Battletech game ever, I think.
I think it is. I'm pretty sure. And I got that. I played it at a friend's house. And I just remember there was this endless walking. You could, the map was endless, it seemed like. And you could just walk for an hour holding down the arrow key before you got anywhere. But it was, and I'm, looking it up now on YouTube and looking up some of the images and stuff, like, oh yeah, that brings me back. That really brings me back. But it was a really fun game, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. So I'm going to go with MechWarrior 2 and these old DOS games for sure. What was that again? Shadow, Crescent Hawk's Inception. Those are my favorites.
There was actually a Crescent Hawk's Revenge as well. There were two.
Oh, was there?
So if you can find something that'll run them, you can probably find a DOS emulator that'll run them. You can probably relive your youth.
Oh, that's what I need to do.
No. You need to write more.
Thank you. Okay, good.
Which leaves the last question, the Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. Did you?
Did I? Not really. I'm ashamed to say I was running a couple of my own Kickstarters and getting all that done and just working on the novel and things like that. So I'm ashamed to say I did not do what I should have done for the Kickstarter. But we definitely hit the local game stores here in town and support that way.
And you do actually have a novella in the Kickstarter, don't you?
I believe I do, yeah. Just reasoned enough.
That's Emerald Sword.
Yes, Emerald Sword. That should be Jade Falcon 2, I believe, right? I think it
is. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Which somewhere sitting in the pile of mails I have from the Kickstarter that I filed away safely and keep reminding myself I must download sometime. I suspect is that.
I understand.
It's the problem with Kickstarters, isn't it? You get a whole bunch of fulfillment emails, you tuck them away safely and say, when I've got a minute or two.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then it never happens. Right. So you've started. I mean, you're pretty very much like actually my previous guest in Brian. wrote before he found BattleTech as an outlet for his writing. And I quite often cite him, or I did, oh, I did, until I realised that he was a writer before, as one of these people who'd gone, write some shrapnel, write some more shrapnel, get signed up to write a multi-parter in shrapnel, and then get a novel. Mm-hmm. How did you discover that shrapnel was there and that it was something you wanted to do?
That's a great question. I'm trying to remember where I first came up with it. It was probably, now that I think about it, I think it was probably through Mike Stackpole, because we were acquainted through various comic cons and conventions and things like that, and you know, we're table neighbors and things like that. So we were always talking back and forth about different business things and that side of writing. And I knew he had obviously written for BattleTech, but at the time, and this is going back several years now, I don't think I knew that there had been kind of a resurgence of the game and certainly of the fiction. And so I think he started talking a little bit about that, and I was like, really? So that's a thing that's happening? He's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, dude, I have got to submit to that. So once I had that in mind, I went out and I think just looked it up on the website and ended up connecting with Phil.
There seem to be an awful lot of people who hold Stackpole responsible for them. Yes. Writing for Stackpole.
Yeah, he's
Brian,
a Yoda.
That's almost exactly the story Brian told.
That doesn't surprise me.
I'm talking to Stackpole, and Stackpole said, why don't you write for...
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's really good about that. He takes good care of us.
He does. He seems a thoroughly nice guy.
Oh, he is. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
And you basically just kept enjoying it, kept submitting, I assume. And then what happened? You got the tap on the shoulder and said, we've got a novel here.
Pretty close. Yeah, it sounds, you know, I think my journey was very similar. I believe I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that it was very early on I asked about a book. Like, I did my first short story and then maybe a second one. I was like, when can I write a book? And they're like, okay, take a breath, slow down there, cowboy. Let's take this step by step, make sure you understand what you're getting into. And yeah, like you said, that led to a couple of short stories, led to a serial, which led to the novella, which then ultimately led to this first novel. Yeah. Almost exact same path.
The one you haven't snuck in, which some people seem to do, is the piece of short fiction for the source book.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess I didn't.
It happens.
I can't, because I know there was several months ago or a year ago now, I seem to recall getting an email like, we need three stories. What do you got? I'm like, oh, geez. So I got some stuff out there and then it just vanished into the ether and I had no idea where it ended up going. So that tracks.
They'll turn up somewhere. I mean, there's
will,
so many
yeah.
books in books on the way.
Yes.
And there does seem to be a very healthy tendency from my point of view, because I always enjoy the fiction a great deal. Mm-hmm. There's always, what, three or four bits of fiction in most of the hardback source books these days. So
yes,
I'm sure
they'll
turn up eventually.
Yeah, it'll show up. And, you know, that's the other thing. I'm sure if the you know, casual fan or so to speak, gets the process. I mean, this is a year-long plus process for some of this stuff. I know Shrapnel's a little bit shorter, but not a lot shorter. I know I submitted a short for Phil, I don't know, months ago, and he's like, great, I've got it. It'll get in there. I'll let you know when. You know, it's who knows.
Meanwhile.
Right, exactly. So the whole publishing process is for both the fiction and like the technical side of stuff. It's a very long process. So by the time you turn it in and get it finalized and edited and proofed and everything, it might be 6 months or 12 months before you see it again. And by that time, like, oh yeah, where did that go? I don't remember. So that happens quite a bit in all branches of publishing. It's not just a BattleTech thing for sure.
Oh no, absolutely. So let's talk about Blood Will Rise. Taking over someone else's character to a degree, mm-hmm. aren't you, at this point?
Yes. And
I think because Danai, having featured the previous book, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is as definitely, what's the phrase I'm looking for? Jason had found her a very nice voice. And I don't know if you've heard the audiobook.
I've heard a little bit of it. I need to go buy it, actually, but I like what I heard.
Lisa Lee does a really good job of actually getting into Danai and actually a lot of the other characters. She's actually, mm-hmm. I'm quite picky about my voiceover, about my novel readers, and she's actually really good. But there's, I mean, Jason's basically built on, I assume from talking to both Brian and to Craig, that you're going to tell me the same thing, that you get mm-hmm. here are the high spots we need you to hit.
Yes.
And what you do in between, subject to us approving it, is down to you.
Yes.
Did you have much interaction with Jason to sort of get things in the right lined up?
Actually, no, not for this. I mean, obviously, I spent a lot of time in Blood Will Tell, you know, and had a copy of the book and was kind of tearing it apart from the inside out and trying to figure out where everything was and who was who and doing all that kind of research stuff. But I did not actually connect with him directly that I can think of. I don't think we did. I don't remember doing that. And whether that's, you know, typical or not, I really don't know. I was mostly focused, at least at the beginning of the process, like you said, here's the metrics or the milestones, rather, that we need to hit for the source books and that kind of thing. So make sure you get this in here, and beyond that, have at it and have a good time, which was great. I discovered I worked really, really well with that setup because it's just enough guardrails to kind of keep you focused as a writer and still have enough freedom to explore and do some new things.
But it's one of those things about writing for a setting like BattleTech with advancing lore, mm-hmm. is that you have to do that.
Yes.
Going back to the original trilogy, possibly not so much so for the Great Eth ones, but as soon as you get to the Warrior Trilogy, the Blood of Kerensky mm-hmm. Trilogy, there's some established lore points that have got to be hit.
Yes.
Do you enjoy that as a process, knowing that you're sort of stepping from one point to another and you have to work out how to get there?
Ooh, enjoying is an interesting word. Let me think. I mean, the honest answer is yes and no, because it got really complicated. This specific lore thing has to happen, and it has to happen kind of roughly at this part of the novel, but this other lore thing has to happen X amount of, you know, months or years prior to that. So how do you make that bridge? What is that bridge? And so there's a lot of, like, I would say Tetris almost going on, where you're given all these pieces and you got to fit them together. And that can be very challenging. Having said that, once you've got them and the ideas start to flow, at least for my process, I'd be curious to hear what Jason's process was, as well as for the other authors for that matter. But once the pieces kind of fit together, for me, I get sort of a burst of inspiration or a realization or something, where the patterns kind of start to emerge and you kind of start to see, oh, okay, this belongs here. And if she feels this way, that's going to motivate X, Y, and Z. And so it is very challenging. I definitely had some frustrating days, but overall, it was a really exciting process and I enjoyed it quite a bit.
And do you get every now and then you just get that satisfying clunk as a couple of pieces fall into place and you realize actually this does work?
Yes. And we live for those moments. Mine usually happen in the car or when I'm walking around the house by myself, just talking out loud, trying to figure out the story. It's very much a hit. Like for me, there's almost a physical thing that happens inside my body where it lands, that thunk, like you said, like, oh, yes, this is it.
I'm a D&D DM. And I have a world of a massive sprawling history, and I'm a part-time writer, but I get that when I suddenly realize that you know, I can link this plot, and boing, and oh, ooh.
Yeah.
It's a real buzz, isn't it? I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but you know, that sort of making the world fit together in places where you didn't expect it to is really satisfying. Do you use any tools to plot, or do you just let it roll?
No, that's I for particularly for an assignment like this, I use a lot of Excel sheets, just because it's easier to move blocks around, like you said. So I do use Excel quite a bit, and then I tend to use an online program called Trello, which is sort of an organizational thing, which again allows for much easier moving of things and note keeping, things like that. And one tool that I use very frequently is my voice to text app on my phone, because again, I will frequently solve problems or get ideas when I'm away from my desk, and you cannot miss those things, man. You got to jump on those.
If the muse is not going to come back and revisit.
It is not. And so doing some kind of voice-to-text recording on my phone has bailed me out of a lot of jams. Those are probably like the top three things that I use.
Trello, it's an interesting one. I mean, my real life is spent as a software engineer. We use it as a project tracking system. Mm-hmm. But I've not come across anyone using it as a plot tracking system.
Yeah.
Do you write in Word or one of the writing apps?
I do all my composing in Word. And then I also, kind of to go back to the tools question, just remembered, particularly for the novel, I did use a lot of the old school folded paper maps, the hex maps and little mechs. And I got on the floor and I would map out the battles with the minis, because I trying to keep this, you know, 1,000-foot view of the battlefield. I had to do that. I couldn't just do it in my head. So I use that as my tool in my toolkit quite a bit as well. But for composing, pretty much just use Word.
And how much of that survived contact with the fact check team?
Oh my gosh. Like,
actually, you can't get from there to there in that time.
Those guys are machines. The stuff that, I mean, their deep bench of lore and technical knowledge and this, and it's just like on the tip of their tongue. Like, they just know it. They're not even looking it up, I don't think. And I love them and I loathe them, because inevitably, yeah, there will be a scene where it's like, oh, this is so cool. And they're like, you can't do that. Like, but come on, it's so cool. Nope. Like, ugh. So I'm so glad they're there. And I hope the fans appreciate them as well, because, man, they work so hard on behalf of us authors.
Mm-hmm. Right. So now, obviously, we're about 3 weeks behind publication date?
Just about, yeah. It's changed around a few times, but it is definitely going to be April.
And I don't have an ARC, so I can't actually comment, and we shouldn't spoiler at this remove. Mm-hmm. But, so, when's it start? When's it finish? What can you tell us?
Oh, boy. Okay, let me think about that for a minute, make sure I don't upset the apple cart there.
We're going to have to dance around. Also, of course, there's a whole bunch of stuff happening in Ilkhan's Eyes Only.
Right.
Which, yes, I'm assuming is wrapped fairly intricately around the novel.
It is, very much so. Yeah. Okay, let me think.
We'll start with the obvious question. Do you finish on the same cliffhanger?
I finish on the same cliffhanger. I'm going to go the safe route and say no comment.
All right. Okay, good.
Just to be on the safe side.
Oh, dear.
Let's see. This is all my... trying to remember where exactly this is. I feel like
so Blood Will Tell leaves off with Danai being recalled to Liao.
It picks up. I can tell you that we do cover some time. Mm-hmm. There's a few years in there, to be sure.
Because Blood Will Tell ends late September 3149.
Yes, we pick up in sort of fall 3149.
Right.
So not too far away, and we are, can I say this part? I think I can say that we are back on Liberty to start things off. I think that's okay. There's a little bit of a prologue that is very, and I'm not a big fan of prologues, but for this particular piece, it was really necessary and sets things up really, really nicely. So, we've got that going on, and Yeah, so Dan is going to be doing some traveling around a bit. We're going to see some very familiar faces from Blood Will Tell. And I think, you know, now that I think about it, to kind of touch back on talking about on Blood Will Tell and the work that Jason did, I have to say his writing was so good and the novel was so well constructed that it was really easy to kind of pick up that ball and keep running with it. You know what I mean? That he drew things out so cleanly that it was very simple to kind of pick up and say, okay, this is who these characters are, and here's some places I can take them now based on what he's given them. So that's been really great. But sorry, I'm trying to dance away from the questions here.
I apologize.
No, because I know I get it. I'm mostly just want to see the book out there so everybody can see for themselves where things go. So yeah, we cover a couple of years there, and there's definitely a lot of travel and quite a bit of political intrigue.
Of course. At this point, you know, Liao is expanding almost around Terra. Mm-hmm. And then getting into a major dust up and getting, I think, the Bloodswiftery is unexpanded again. So there's an awful lot of this. There's quite a bit of military action going on. Are you? I mean, and Danai is at this point. She's actually running the Big Mac, isn't she?
She's yeah, correct.
So she's kind of fairly heavily involved, I guess.
She is involved in different areas, yeah, and that is actually, I think, it's safe to say one of the sort of primary conflicts in the book is the things that she's being tasked with doing. There are multiple motives into why she's doing the things she's doing and why she's being sent to the theaters that she's being sent to. So she might be showing up in some places that would be surprising and unexpected, unless you're Daoshin, who knows, of course, exactly what he's doing every step of the way. And that is a big source of tension in the novel.
But I think that's been a part of her life for a long time.
A long time.
I mean, Blood Will Tell, it's one of the primary focuses. Along that whole conflict between being a mech warrior, which I think, as you said in that little teaser piece you put up not so long ago, between being a mech warrior and being the chancellor's, should we go with relative?
Well, that's a good word. Yeah, those things come to a point, I can say confidently, in Blood Will Rise, because, like, yeah, as you said, that's that conflict between those two very specific human people is really at the center of a lot of the bigger, broader scope of things. And that plays out definitely in Blood Will Tell and comes up again, not comes up, but is central to Blood Will Rise.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I've personally always drawn me to BattleTech is that it's not just a big stompy robots universe. Mm-hmm. There are people. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've characterized it as Game of Thrones with big stompy robots.
Yeah, that works.
And there is so much characterization that I think that's what makes the novels actually work beyond just and X robot stomped Y robot.
Yes, I agree. And that's, you know, again, going back to when I was first learning how to play the game all these decades ago now, some of the people we played with, they weren't into that. And so the rest of us kind of never got the opportunity to learn about that. And it was a shame because those very personalities and interpersonal conflicts and the politics and everything really have an impact on the battlefield and thus the game. So I feel like as a kid, I missed out on a lot of the opportunities there that we could have had some really more in-depth gameplay. And I agree. Yeah. Having the novels now and the short stories and Shrapnel, all these, this great fiction that's coming out from the company now really just underscores and heightens the battle, and it heightens the going onto the tabletop and having a big stompy robot firing at you. It's a different feeling now.
One of the things, one of my other podcasts is covers quite a lot of the theory behind wargaming generally. And one of the things that I think I found, and I actually use BattleTech as an example, is that the nice thing about a universe like BattleTech is it gives you context for your games.
There you go. That's a great way to put it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know, there's a whole thing where you can turn up on a club night, you can go, I'll have 3,000 points, you can have 3,000 points, I'll have a battle, and it's done and gone. But if you can actually say, and the story behind this is this, you know why you're fighting. I think it makes the game more fun.
It does. It does. I remember very clearly when, because I started, you know, Succession War era, and then we played for, I don't know, a few years, and then the clan happened, so to speak. And we were just like, whoa, look at this. We were, you know, so impressed with the technology and all the game mechanics we could do and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't really until years later that I went back and said, oh, wait, there's a reason. Oh, this is why the clans did what they did. This is who they are. This is the whole backstory. And if we'd had that at the time, the gameplay would have been so much richer.
You could do things like put yourself into the shoes of that poor little mercenary unit that's garrisoning some periphery world. Yeah. And then these things turn up.
Yeah. I mean, I'm getting excited just thinking about it. Like, yeah, that would be like, what a cool scenario instead of like, well, pick a map at random and go in with your two assaults. Like, okay, fun, but not every Saturday.
Fun, but not, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely right. I was looking through, just detouring slightly, I'm looking through your website. I notice on your list of books, there's an interesting, as we were discussing, the practice of writing, how to write awesome dialogue.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Sure. So one of the advantages I think that I brought into the prose fiction / novel arena was my background in theater. My opinion as a theater person was, if you go to see, you know, Hamilton or Les Mis or 12 Angry Men or, you know, pick whatever, Shakespeare, anything, you go to see a show like that, the cast, the actors should be able to stand on that stage in street clothes and either belt out those songs or give you that performance with no special effects, no extra lighting, no costumes, no anything, and blow you away. If they can't, then there's probably something wrong with the show, something fundamental. And as theater people, as actors, what we get is our body and the dialogue. It's all spoken. That's the whole point. And so I'm bringing this different ways of looking at how to use and manipulate the spoken word in prose in ways that I think a lot of other authors just haven't had the opportunity to experience.
Yeah, it's the songwriter's equivalent of, does this work on one acoustic guitar?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
rather than the full E Street Band or whoever. Where can I get it?
That should be available. It's definitely available on Amazon. And it should be available also as an ebook on most other ebook platforms.
Right. I will pop that one in the show notes, because I know there's quite a few people, certainly in the UK BattleTech community, who are wannabe writers, me included.
Yeah. No, I think what I like about the book is the first, I don't know, quarter of it or so really talks about plot and structure, because if you don't have a great plot, then there isn't going to be good dialogue. That's you have to hang good dialogue on a great plot. So it kind of gives a crash course into what makes a good plot and what kind of, you know, what do you have to get lined up in order to make the dialogue really come alive and sing? And it's definitely out of the box, because I'm coming at it again from a different perspective than someone who's been just writing prose their whole life.
Do you find that whole theater background, you know, in ways other than that, influences how you write prose?
I think it does. I know there are other authors who do this, but I definitely, I have a creative writing class that I teach, and somebody asked me recently, like, do you like say all this stuff out loud? And I'm like, yep, absolutely. Like, I do, you know, a lot of speaking out loud and kind of getting into character, so to speak, as I'm working on certain scenes, because that's, for me as a former actor, that is the best way to get in touch with my body and with the character. And, you know, those things come into play. How is Danai sitting right now when she's saying this line? Cause that's going to change how it comes out. What's her emotional state? Well, it's going to be like this. And how does that impact her body? Is she, you know, so all these things kind of come together in the body, in the voice, in the mind. And it's a real, I think for me, it's been a privilege to have that experience.
Are you one of these visual people who sees the scene as you're writing it?
Generally speaking, yes. And I can tell when I'm not, because the writing gets a little bit more flat. It's kind of a rote, like, okay, I just got to get from point A to point B. Or like, well, you probably do this in Dungeons and Dragons. I'm sure this has happened to you, where the party gets to the lake and they're going to spend the next 3 hours trying to figure out how to get across the lake. And as the DM, you're like, just get in the boat. Just get in the boat. My God, you know. So I run into that sometimes where there's just these paragraphs like, okay, I just have to get her from here to there. Ugh. Okay, now I can get to the fun part where she's going to fight with so-and-so, or there's a mech battle, or there's, you know, whatever. So yeah, it's a very personal and physical experiential experience for me a lot of times.
So, right, for those wondering, it is available on Amazon. I will put a link in the show notes. It's available on Kindle Unlimited, but you don't want to do that. You want to buy the paper copy, because that way, actually, Tom makes some money out of it.
That would be super cool.
Yes. I'm not sure why it slid onto Kindle Unlimited, but
thank you, you see very
little of that, I suspect, do you?
Yeah, I'm going to have to double check that. I'm not sure if that's how that's supposed to be set up.
Whoops.
Yeah, thank you.
Ordered since I found the Amazon page.
Oh, thank you. Sweet. This has been a good day.
I have a small library of things that I should read more and do more with, and that certainly looks like a good addition to it, because I have problems with dialogue.
It's hard to do. That's the thing. It's hard to talk about that. Yeah.
And just not make it sound stilted.
Yes, it really is. I think this will be very helpful, because it's a very organic way of looking at how to write dialogue and ways to rethink about what's happening. You know, I'm trying to think, what's a good example? So here's just a quick lesson. In theater, we have what's called a French scene. And the French scene, I have no idea why it's called that anymore. I've long since forgotten. But it basically just means every time there is an exit or an entrance, the relationships change. Right. So if you've got, you know, two characters in a room and they're talking about whatever, and then a third character enters, that entire relationship has shifted just a little bit, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little. And the types of words, the cadence, the rhythm, word choice, sentence length, all of these things change either a lot or a little based on who's actually in the scene. And that's not something that gets taught in a typical writing class. So hopefully that will be helpful.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
So moving on from that to audio, do you know if they're going to do an audiobook for Bloody Words?
I have not heard, but I really hope so, because please, I love audiobooks.
Please get Lisa to do it if they do, if you get any say at all. She so had the voice for Danai. I drive a couple of hours a day each way on a weekend fairly regularly to visit my dad, and audiobooks are the thing that keeps me sane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, it's the one probably I've enjoyed the most in terms of the quality of the reading and the fit with the character, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I as you know, like, I don't have a say, but like, I'm going to guess, and this is nothing I've heard, so I'm really speaking for myself here, I would assume they will. I don't imagine that they would do Blood Will Tell and then skip Blood Will Rise. That seems unlikely. The best way to make it happen, I'm sure, is to make sure we sell a lot of copies. That generally tends to influence the production of other forms of the story. So hopefully that'll happen. Yeah.
And it's coming out on the 8th. Did I say the 18th?
Gosh, is it the 18th?
Of April.
That might be right. That might be right.
Let's have one of these embarrassing pauses while we both go and check.
I know, right? At one point, it was the 4th. And I know it's not the 4th anymore. So,
Battletoad-related world. Good old Sana. 18th of April 2025, according to Sana, which I tend to trust in these things.
Generally speaking, yeah, yeah.
Right, God cool. Bless so. Sana. 18th of April, available from all reputable stores, and I'm guessing that'll be the Kindle version, and the print-on-demand version will be out then or closely thereafter.
I assume, yeah, should be.
What's next?
What's next? That's a great question. So I I'm not 100% sure what I can say, so I'll definitely mince my words a little bit here, but I had a great conversation with one of my editors a couple of weeks ago, and I can tell you that I pitched a one sentence idea, and he immediately was like, I want that, do it. It's like, sweet, thank you. So that's something is hopefully coming up. There's I believe I can say that there's been some discussions about wanting to do more of the serialized novels or four-part novellas that then lead into a final packaged novel that then is released separately. So I know they're looking for some things like that. So I'm interested in dipping my toes into that well again as well, though I haven't specifically pitched anything. And then as far as the Ill Clan, I can't say for sure, other than there are discussions, and I'm hopeful.
So you're going to be kept busy, though.
I sure hope so, because this has been, again, talking to 15-year-old Tom has been a complete sort of dream come true to like be in this world and be a part of it. And to be terrified of it, by the way, in case anyone's wondering, it is terrifying to follow in the footsteps of Mike and all these other people, and to know that I'm handling lore characters. Like this is canon now. Dude, don't mess this up. It is frightening.
Have a responsibility to the universe and to the fans.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, the good news, as you've stated, like it's not just me. It has to get through various gatekeepers and make sure that we're all on the same page and everything. So it's certainly not just me. Just like it wasn't just me and Spawn when I was writing for Spawn. You know, Todd's got to say yes or no to things and whatever. But it's still you feel the weight of an IP like this on you, at least I do, the entire time, which I think is good. And I think it means there's a needed respect there for the work and for all the work that's come before me, you know. So hopefully
there's a phrase I see quite a bit, which is actually, do you follow the guys on, I think, on Of Mechs and Men? I think it's one of their sign-off lines is thanking Catalyst for being the custodians of the universe. And I think that's a lovely turn of phrase.
It is. I love that. I love that a lot. Yep. That sums it up. And I think they're doing that. I think they are well tuned into the fans. I think they have respect for the work. I think they have love and passion for the work, because you have to, you know, there's other things we could be doing, man. And you have to love it. So, and I think they're doing a great job of that. And yeah, that's a perfect phrase to describe Catalyst.
Yeah. You seem to be enjoying yourself as part of that.
I am. Yes.
So I have to ask, if you manage to sell an idea on a one sentence pitch, I'm guessing that's going to be slightly less of the hit the high spots and more of the I've got a story to tell here.
Yes, I think so. I know that they are generally looking for, I mean, there's this kind of work, right? There's Blood Will Rise, Blood Will Tell, that really is in support of the source books and all the technical things like that.
The art novels, as it were.
Yes, exactly. But this is such a big universe with so many things, and I've heard tell of some interest from the higher ups. Like, we really want to see some more stuff happening over in this part of the universe and that part of the universe, and it will still be canon, but it might not necessarily, you know, directly impact a source book, for example, or things like that. And that is definitely more of a, ooh, I get to tell my story now and really jump in and just kind of mix things up and see what happens. So I'm looking forward to that.
Also, of course, there are holes all over the place.
Yes. I've seen and people again, talk about that.
I guess you could occasionally have that satisfying moment of going, I've just seen how that hole fills.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I see that a lot on some of the message boards. Like, where's this? There's this big blank spot between here and there. What's going on? Like, yep, we don't know, but somebody's going to write about it. So look forward to it.
That's what shrapnel's for.
It is.
Fabulous. Right. I think that's about covers it. Much as I'd like to grill you about the contents of Blood Will Rise, we're probably going to have to wait for that one.
I know. I'm so sorry.
No. I am intrigued. I would suggest that if you have, to my listeners, if you have not managed to source a copy of Ill Clan's Eyes Only, which I appreciate is difficult in the UK, but you can get the PDF off the Catalyst store, there's probably some subtle spoilers, but not of the in-depth variety.
Correct, yes.
In there, although it's a fairly big and fairly fairly densely packed read that covers not very many worlds in quite a bit of detail. And I think I certainly, if you want to feel for the kind of things that Danai and Daoshen and the Confederation are getting up to, I'd certainly recommend it as a bit of pre-reading, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
In which case, I guess we'll wrap it there. My guest has been Tom Levine, author of the upcoming Blood Will Rise, which you can get from all reputable Battletech book stockists, starting, I suspect, with the Catalyst store itself, Amazon, you name it, it'll be there, and in Kindle version ebooks, and probably arriving in print on demand not long afterwards.
That sounds right, yep.
Lovely job. Right. My thanks to Tom. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Let's get on to the events diary, shall we? Beginning on April the 26th at the Nan McKay Community Hall in Glasgow, the Scottish Battletech Nationals. Hall will be open from 10 o'clock for registration and the drawing for pairs for round one. The entry fee is £15, which includes some money to cover the hall. And you can find the details on the Facebook event, which, as ever, is linked off the directory at talesfortheperiphery.org.uk. Next up, campaign Milton Keynes. It's the Milton Keynes Wargame Show. It actually takes place in the Middleton Hall in centre.mk, which is a massive public space. So all the games there are participation. They're designed to draw in the general public, so a lot of them tend to be pitched so that anybody can come and dip in. Silver from the Discord is running both Battletech and Alpha Strike games, including an Alpha Strike Battle for Twycross, introductory classic games, and a 6K 3025 game session. You can bring your own mechs, no LozTech, no Starleague Tech, Innosphere only, and prior to 2025. Admission is free. That is the whole weekend of May the 10th and the 11th. It's a really great event. I and Peterborough Wargames Club will be there. We are doing something sci-fi, which has absolutely nothing to do with Battletech. And I'm not going to say any more than that. If you've seen a couple of my progress pictures on the Discord, you are free to wonder about my sanity. Next. The following weekend, at Ponders End United Reformed Church Hall, the lovely folks from Ponders End Gaming Gamers, which is to say Rich Shadowblade, regular on the Discord, and Sam, who has previously been a guest on this very show, are doing a 500 PV per player mass reenactment of the Battle for Twycross. So it's Clan Invasion era, master unit lists only, tenner a player to cover hall hire. There will be 2-3 hour scenarios, much like there were for the Battle of Luthien a few days ago. You can bring Clan Jade Falcon or IS Clan General lists, or Fedcom, Fedsons, Laren Commonwealth, Mercenary General. Details again are on the website. And last, but in no way least, it's UK Games Expo from May the 30th, which is a Friday, to June the 1st at the NEC in Birmingham. Sadly, for those who've been asking, Catalyst will not be there, so there's no big Catalyst demo and gaming presence in the main hall, but we, as the demo agents, do have a whole bunch of tables in the events hall, and we will be putting on a whole bunch of stuff. For example, we have Drafted for War, which is a 3-round Alpha Strike tournament. You get 3 Merc salvage boxes, and then via a drafting format involving pick one, pass them on, you get to keep the mechs at the end of it. There's a Mercenaries campaign, bring your Scale 1 Hinterlands Merc Force, so that's 2 mechs, 3,000 BV total, take on a contract with 3 tracks against other Mercs. there's a possibility this may be not the hinterlands, depending on what interesting new material Catalyst have given us to try. We've also got access to Aces Shifting Sands, which is the collaborative Aces game against a card-driven AI. If you've seen videos at Adepticon and similar, you can already get an idea of how fun this is. It's well worth checking out. For those of you into Leviathans, there's a Leviathan Shakedown Cruise. If you want to learn how to play, there is a King of the Skies, which is like the Battletech grinder. You basically stay on and keep killing people and keep advancing, which is King of the Skies. There is a Shadowrun scenario. There are some events for our younger players. Camospecs Online folks are going to be there doing painting techniques, and you will get a chance to paint with a Camospecs Online dude. There'll be a meet the authors. We have at least a couple of published CGL authors in the team. Chance to meet them and ask questions. If there's enough interest, I might see if I can wangle a moderated chat with them, but that's kind of going to be a bit up in the air. And then there will be boot camps. Come talk to us and say, teach me this, and we'll see what we can do. I think that covers it. Huge thanks to Arthur on the Discord, who's been flogging his guts out putting this together, to everybody else who's volunteered, to Martin Sweeney and to CGL, who've been providing us with all manner of goodies so we can actually do this, and to my former guest Andy Dickinson, who, as far as I can tell, dedicated an entire suitcase to bringing the King of the Skies kit back so we could actually run the Leviathans demo. There will be a link in the show notes to where you can sign up for the events, and hopefully we'll see you there. If you catch me and tell me you listen to the podcast, I should have pairs of the podcast dice to give away, assuming I remember to put the order in. Right, and that's it for events. I don't think I have any new directory entries, but I suspect this is more an omission on my part rather than a lack of new information. If you want to get your club or your store regular meetings mentioned on here and on the website directory, please just drop me a note in all the usual places. I'm Fleetfoot Mike on the Discord, or info@talesfromtheperiphery.org.uk will reach me, and we'll get you up on there and get you a plug on the show. Right, that's it for this episode. Once again, my apologies for it being quite as long as it has been. But here we are. I'd like to dedicate this episode to a late friend of mine, A.D. Walker. I don't normally do this kind of thing, but I was reminded, actually on the Battletech Discord tonight, chatting to Rod Smith, who is ex-RAF. He popped up a photo of his unit in Belize in the early 80s, where my friend A.D. happened to be serving. And to my considerable surprise, we are pretty sure that A.D. is in fact one of the figures in the photo, perched on the top of a Harrier in a pair of aviator shades, looking very much like A.D. Now, sadly, A.D. passed away in January 2019, leaving behind his widow, who is my wife's best friend. A.D. was one of my best friends. And I know he was a keen fan of military sci-fi, of war games online, and if I'd ever got a chance, in person. And I like to think he'd have been a big fan of playing Battletech if we'd ever had a chance to get together. I mean, with him living in Shetland, it was always a little impractical. But anyway, this one's for you, mate. Miss you a great deal. It was nice to be reminded of you. Which only remains for me to say, as ever, have fun, roll good dice, see you at the next one. Tales from the Periphery is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. In short, give us some credit. Don't make money out of it. And if you make an adaptation of it, you must share it under the same license. Have fun.